Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The attacks on U.S. forces are coming 87 a day now in Iraq, and there's blood all over. 200 Iraqis killed by insurgents in the last 4 days. 47 in the middle of Baghdad in a single bombing yesterday. Insurgents blew up an oil pipeline over the Tigris. Billions will be lost. Power went out across the whole country. Today, three more beheaded bodies, another car bomb with a dozen dead and wounded, U.S. forces clashing with insurgents again. And the number of U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq now tops 1,015. The escalating violence and brazen attacks by insurgents threatens Iraq's national elections, nervously slated now for January. The insurgency itself is growing in numbers, in sophistication, in violence. And now some senior Bush administration officials say the U.S. strategy of creating a democratic, free, and stable Iraq is in danger of failing. Just how bad is it from Baghdad to Kirkuk and Basra? One Newsweek headline says it's worse than you think. Tonight on Point, flirting with failure in Iraq. We'll talk with journalists in Baghdad and analyst Anthony Cordesman in Washington. And we'll take a deep look at security and strategy on the ground now. Joining me now from Baghdad is Babak Deganpeshe, correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Babak, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Also with us from Washington is Anthony Cordesman, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Anthony Cordesman, good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Babak, first to you in Baghdad. It's your headline, or at least your magazine's, It's Worse Than You Think. Take us into the outlines. What are the major elements that people are not fully aware of? Why are you saying it's worse than we think in Iraq?
Well, really, the biggest thing is the level of the insurgency. I mean, there was this big uprising in April, both in the Sunni areas and in the Shia areas. And again, we saw a flare-up of this just last month. So now, what we have are basically, certain cities that are off-limits to both, security forces of the Iraqi interim government and U.S. forces are also not going into these areas. That would include Fallujah, Ramadi, Baquba, and parts of the Shiite South, and even here in Baghdad, in the district of Sadr City, the U.S. troops are engaging a lot of insurgents there. So, the main backbone of the security situation deteriorating is the ongoing insurgency. But also, it's complicated because of the widespread kidnapping, the economic breakdown of the country. So there's a lot of things that really feed into that.
Babak, the word we hear from Washington, from the Bush administration, seems to be essentially, look, we'll muddle through until we get a lot of Iraqi forces trained up, and then we will clean all this up. The elections will have gone on with or without full participation, and we'll be on our way. Does that look realistic from Iraq?
Well, the problem is that up to now, if we look at what's been done up to now, it's really been a concentration on building up the numbers of Iraqi security forces, which haven't met fully the goals that the U.S. officials had set out. But there are quite a few Iraqi National Guard and Iraqi police out on the street. But the main question is, what are the quality of those individuals being put out on the street? Are they adequately trained? Have they adequately been screened? And, some recent examples are pretty disturbing, particularly down at Najaf during the recent trouble. Some of the policemen there opened fire on crowds and killed and wounded several people. So, this is a big concern.
Anthony Cordesman in Washington, we're going to hear a lot from Baghdad tonight, but you've been watching on very carefully, and you've seen signs this week of a fundamental shift in Bush administration strategy in Iraq. In effect, you say a recognition that much of the U.S. effort in the first year of occupation was a failure.
It's not one that you're going to have openly, of course, discussed in an election year, but the reprogramming of money into the security and law enforcement agencies or staffs in Iraq is just one sign of exactly the kind of problem that's just been discussed.
And this was the $3.5 billion being directed this week out of the $18 billion away from reconstruction and towards security, directly?
Well, $1.8 billion, because a lot of the money goes really to short-term efforts to provide aid to the Iraqis to deal with what the economic problems are, and then to try to accelerate some kind of effort to make the elections more credible and prepare the Iraqis for them. But understand, when you reprogram money, that doesn't mean you spent it. And reprogramming, when it occurs in mid-September, is not going to occur very effectively between now and December, when the elections are supposed to occur.
Or January, I guess people are saying.
In January, or many people honestly say at the embassy level and in Baghdad, the first quarter, whatever that may mean.
Mm-hmm.
But it is certainly true this is the first step. I think the other problem that really emerges out of this, however, is what's happening in the areas where the money hasn't been reprogrammed. And so far, we spent just about $1,100 million of the $18.4 billion in terms of not actual expenditures, but money given to the contractors. And out of that money, only about half has actually gone into Iraq. And that raises major questions about what happens with the remaining money.
You've written this week that Paul Bremer, the CPA, and the U.S. military essentially got the first year of coalition occupation in Iraq fundamentally wrong. You've said that this reprogramming, redirecting of major sums of money is a de facto recognition that the neocon goals set for restructuring Iraq can never be achieved. What do you mean by that, Anthony Cordesman?
Well, first, I don't think anyone expects this election to occur peacefully, to produce a stable democracy, to somehow, by some point in 2006, create a government that isn't going to have a great many problems or that won't have many differences from what we would like to see in terms of a rule of law and human rights. It is a fact of life that virtually every economic effort we made to privatize and restructure Iraq's economy is no longer being supported by the U.S., much less by Iraqi ministries, with the exception of a few areas like financial reform. And certainly one of the key mistakes that the military made after the fall of Saddam, which was to assume that we, the U.S. and coalition, could defeat the insurgents quickly, and that we wouldn't need Iraqi security forces and military forces that were properly trained and equipped and given the facilities they needed, that particular assumption failed as of last April. And that's one of the reasons, first, General Petraeus was brought in to make the effort effective, and second, people are desperately now trying to rush money into the program to create forces that can take the mission over from the coalition.
Babak Daganpiche, in Baghdad, you quote U.S. troops who are watching the American political debate over the presidential election, and you quote them saying, stop talking about Vietnam. People should be debating this war. You report a widespread agreement that Washington needs to rethink its objectives in Iraq and quickly. Rethink in what direction, Babak?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? I mean, it's really tough to put your finger on exactly what the military objective is at the moment. I mean, would winning constitute a face-saving exit from Iraq? Would it mean going out and cleaning out all of these insurgent towns at who knows what cost in terms of public opinion and civilian lives? Again, this is an open question, and it is a question that those people on the ground are posing.
You quote a senior U.S. diplomat, American diplomat in Baghdad, saying, the idea of a functioning democracy here is crazy. All hell is breaking loose. Is there a defeatism in the air there, or what's the attitude that you sense among American officials, American soldiers?
Well, certainly there's a reality check. I think one of the last options left was this handover to the interim government, and it hasn't gone nearly as well as maybe some U.S. officials had anticipated. I mean, again, a couple of months after this handover, it certainly doesn't seem to have calmed the insurgency down, which may have been the expectation. So, yes, either a reality check, a sense of defeatism, you know, however you want to phrase it, you know, that there are some officials who are sounding alarm bells.
And meanwhile, there are fairly wide areas of the country, any number of cities now, where American troops essentially cannot go, Babak.
That's correct. That's correct. And, you know, again, it's not that militarily that the U.S. forces couldn't go in there and fight it out and, you know, over a period of time very likely take control of those cities. But, again, the bigger question is at what cost?
Anthony Cordesman, everyone's talking this week about an evolution in the insurgency in Iraq, moving away from just recruiting and crude roadside bombs to many more U.S. casualties now coming from gunfire, people willing to shoulder a rifle, point, you know, aim, and fire at U.S. troops in significant numbers, the biggest number of wounded yet just last month in August. What do you see in the evolution of this insurgency?
Well, first, it's important to note you've seen a steady evolution. It hasn't been something that's just happened. You've seen more sophisticated improvised explosive devices. You've seen better uses of grenades. You've seen mortar attacks become more effective. You've seen them do a better job of planning ambushes. You've seen tactics change from being directed against U.S. targets to targets like the U.N., and NGOs, the use of kidnappings and executions to basically intimidate other countries and try to break up the coalition. And you're watching cadres develop, which now have something like a year of combat expertise. And while some of these have been broken up and destroyed, I think that U.S. officials and U.S. officers on the ground are the first to admit that there are more hostile insurgents today in the various factions than there were when the insurgency began, and they're a lot more experienced. And I think you're going to see, for example, as we move toward the election, another evolution. You're going to see more killings of Iraqi candidates. You're going to see deliberate efforts to use explosives and attacks to break up the electoral process. You're going to see efforts as we move toward our election to have very dramatic explosions like the ones we had today that knock out power or create incidents with high media visibility. The problem that I think we also face is this is a very diverse group of insurgents. They have different motives in terms of the reason they're attacking, but they have common goals. And they all can see what is successful from watching the other groups in terms of television and press coverage, which substitutes for coordination and a command and control system.
All of which adds up to a controllable problem, a surmountable problem at some point, or something that's just gotten away from U.S. and Iraqi forces. Can it be reined back in?
Well, that's a very good question. And the only way to know, and Babak raised the key issue, is to find out how many Iraqi security forces and military forces we can really bring online and how effective they can become over time. And the fact is that we really only started to do this in April. We have some cadres at battalion size that have been relatively effective, but most of the 200,000-odd people we sometimes report on have almost no training and equipment and very poor facilities. And we're not going to have them ready by the time of the election unless the election is really deferred to some point in the spring or summer of next year.
Babak Daganpache in Baghdad, your quick thought on that election. Do you expect it to actually take place in January?
I really don't see, you know, with the current security situation, how it could go ahead in January, really. There's been talk in some quarters of not holding elections in some of these problematic cities like Ramadi and Fallujah. And some of the Iraqi officials I've talked to think that would be disastrous, really. You know, one of the people that is mentioned in the story, Mr. Bassan Atiyah, mentioned that badly planned elections or rushed elections are really much worse than holding no elections at all.
Worse than none at all. Babak Daganpache, co-author of It's Worse Than You Think, the Newsweek story. Thank you so much for joining us from Baghdad tonight. Great to hear from you. Thanks for being with us, and take care of yourself there.
No problem. Thank you.
Anthony Cordesman, please stand by. We've got much more coming. We are looking at the U.S. effort flirting with failure in Iraq tonight. We recorded this earlier so we can get in touch with our correspondents in Baghdad. So no calls tonight, but listen closely. There's a lot to hear. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the U.S. effort in Iraq flirting with failure. It's not a pretty thing to contemplate, but a bunch of pieces are not going well. Elections are supposed to be in January. Many are not sure they will come. We're looking at what exactly is going on tonight. We're joined tonight from Washington by Anthony Cordesman. He's senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, author of many books, including The Iraq War. We are joined now from Baghdad by Howard LaFranchi. He is correspondent there for the Christian Science Monitor. Howard, thanks for joining us tonight.
Sure. It's a pleasure.
And from Baghdad, we are joined by Anne Bernard, correspondent for the Boston Globe. Anne, good evening and welcome from Baghdad.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you again.
It's great to have you. Anne Bernard, you've had a couple of very interesting stories just in recent days, one with the head of the Marine effort in Fallujah. We'll get to that. But first, you actually sat down with the Prime Minister of Iraq, Prime Minister Alawi, a few days ago. He had a cast on one of his arms. Reportedly, he told you, from banging his desk in exasperation or frustration, I'm not sure, but maybe there's a little tension in that office. What's your sense in talking with the Prime Minister of Iraq, and do you feel confidence that things are headed towards some kind of acceptable future there from him or not?
Well, Dr. has always made an effort to appear as a strong man. And so in some ways, I think he told that story to portray himself as decisive and maybe a little bit passionate. But there are a lot of reasons for him to be frustrated. At the moment, he has said that it's important to bring under control the many parts of Iraq that right now are beyond the control of either Iraqi forces or U.S. forces, and in many other parts where U.S. forces are present, but where it's really impossible to move ahead with reconstruction and elections. But he faces a huge dilemma in trying to do that. Now that Iraq is sovereign, at least nominally, it wouldn't feel right for Americans to go in on their own and carry out massive offensives as they tried to do in Fallujah with disastrous political effects in April. At the same time, the Marine commanders, the Army commanders, as well as the Iraqis admit that Iraqi forces are really nowhere near ready to carry out operations like this. So that leaves open the question of how, within a few short months until January, they're going to bring in enough security for the election.
Now, Anne, let me ask you, the UN representative today is saying we don't have enough people in Iraq to pull this off. The UN, of course, is supposed to play a crucial role in these elections. Tell us, Anne, first of all, who is to be elected in this election, and what happens if it's delayed?
Well, there's three elections that are supposed to take place. The most important one, the one that everybody talks about, is the election to a national legislature, which will also draft the country's constitution. On top of that, though, they're supposed to elect provincial councils for Iraq's 18 provinces or states. And the third election is supposed to take place in the semi-autonomous region in the north of Kurdistan. So that's a lot to get done purely from a logistical level. I was talking to the Iraqi election officials as well as the UN officials last week, and they said even if security was perfect, which we all know it isn't, it might be difficult to get these elections done in that time frame.
Howard LaFranchi, you've been talking with a lot of Iraqis about how they're viewing everything that's going on. Of course, many Iraqis have died just in the last few days. Many have died in the last year and a half. What's your sense of Iraqis and these elections? Do they look forward to them as critical? Do they believe they're going to come on schedule?
Well, I think there's a hope that they will, because what I'm sort of seeing is a short-term deep pessimism and actually bitterness about the way the post-war period has gone. It's not what they expected at all. It's not what they felt they were promised. There's a long-term optimism, I would say, and that's sort of easier to have in this kind of a situation. I think it's sort of a natural human reaction, the way they find it very difficult to be optimistic in the short term. but as almost everyone tells me, we're an optimistic people, so let's look to the future. And the current situation doesn't look bright at all, so there is a hope that that maybe the elections could change things. But that's the kind of hope, unfortunately, that could be dashed very quickly. Just this evening, I was talking to an Iraqi out on the street. We talked a bit about the elections, and I said, well, how would you vote if there were elections? And he said, I don't know. I now think all our leaders are very bad. And it was sort of sad because one minute he was telling me, you know, that he had hope in the elections, but when it came down to the specifics of how he might think of voting, he had no idea and thought all the options were bad.
Anthony Cordesman in Washington, give us some perspective here. You have written, as we've said, that at this point, much of the first year of the occupation appears to have been a failure, that the neocon goals, the neoconservative goals of restructuring Iraq, can never be achieved in all likelihood. And that's saying a lot, because these are goals President Bush still trumpets, the goal of a stable democratic Iraq that would sort of be the seed of remaking the Middle East. If there's a failure at that level, if that's not going to happen, and perhaps it still will, but we're hearing a lot of difficulty out there, does it mean that the U.S. effort overall ends up being a failure? Is failure in that regard failure overall?
Well, first, I think President Bush has never specifically said, as the neocons have, that one of the goals was to have Iraq become an example that would transform the Middle East. And in that sense, when he talks about a stable democracy, of course, that may happen, whether it happens in 2 years, 3 years, or 5 years. It's still possible. But a stable democratic Iraq could still be one in which there were deep divisions between Sunni and Shiite and Kurd, in which the many of the goals we set for human rights and the rule of law did not occur. And it's all too clear that whatever happens, there's no Iraqi constituency for the kind of drastic reform of the economy and the state industries and the oil industry that were one of the other goals of the neocons. I think that we need to be, however, a little careful about being too pessimistic. People understood from the start that as we move toward the election, the insurgents would step up their operations, that there would be serious problems in including the Sunnis, or at least they understood this by the beginning of this year. And many of the people doing the planning understood that the election might have to be an election which excluded some areas. That's one of the reasons why the UN created a system where there are national lists rather than district lists. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be smooth, and it's not going to be pretty, regardless of what happens. But we are adjusting our goals. And the question now is whether setting lesser goals, which could produce an Iraq, which would be better than Iraq under the Saddam, can be achieved. I think that's possible. But I don't think anyone believes that why the reasons we set out with, at least from a neocon perspective, are achievable.
Ann Bernard, let me ask you about that. If there's a shift to pragmatism, as Anthony Cordesman describes it, can you see a kind of lowering of goals, a lowering of the ideal that would make the U.S. task in Iraq easier? Or is it just as difficult whether the goals are grand or just getting out, you know, with our hind ends?
Well, I think if that shift had happened 5 or 6 months ago, it might have been great. Right now, it seems like it's going to be difficult just to get to the point where there can be a credible election, the point where most people feel that their personal security is at least equal to what it was before. The security is way more important to most Iraqis right now than the outcome of the election. So, yes, I mean, I think perforce pragmatism has already taken over, at least on the part of the military that we speak to. And their pragmatism comes out in the form of statements like, we just really need to get the Iraqi forces trained up to the point where we can credibly lead. And they're not even talking about democracy that much on the front lines.
You've written very interestingly about the Marine commander who was in charge when the Marines went into Fallujah, who has recently, I guess, left Iraq. And, of course, the Marines came to Iraq with a kind of hearts and minds mission that was then changed after the awful murder of Americans in Fallujah. Then they were sent in to take over the city, and after just a few days, they were pulled back out. If there had been a more pragmatic attitude when all of that happened, might it have changed how the U.S. Marines were used? This Lieutenant General James Conway seemed to end up feeling rather abused in his position in Iraq.
Well, absolutely. It's been a very sad trajectory to watch. I've spent a lot of time with the Marines, who are in charge of really the toughest part of Iraq, in western Iraq and the large part of the Sunni Triangle, including Fallujah and Ramadi. And they came in very excited. They had had special training for dealing with people. They had all read up on peace villages that the Marines ran during Vietnam, where they lived with the people. They were supposed to do these in the western part of Iraq. Within a few days, they had to change because of orders from on high to just go in and take Fallujah. And, of course, that's what the Marines do best, fight and take a city. And they got the order. They were ready to do it, and they were psyched up. I was with some Marines then outside Fallujah. But as the days ticked by, when they found themselves instead in a stalemate, you could hear on the front line low-level officers and the grunts just saying, we don't see the end of this. We don't see the progress that we're making, and we're not doing the thing we were supposed to do, which was come and work with people in their communities. Instead, we're raiding the same house three different times in the same week. Three different units raid the same house. We're picking up roadside bombs, which they're only putting out because we're here, and we're only here to find the roadside bombs, these type of vicious circles. So, you know, General Conway, the reaction we got to the article from some the Marines was, thank goodness he spoke up, because, like, the policy was not clear that they were supposed to be implementing. So, and, you know, they're nothing if not pragmatists, and I think they were being forced to conform to a lot of different political ideas.
So did General Conway ultimately come away feeling they would have been better off not to have attacked Fallujah, or having attacked, that they should have been as destructive as necessary in order to really claim victory, if that was possible at all?
Exactly. He made the strongest public comments to date criticizing the policy decisions, both to go into Fallujah when they did and then once they had gone in to sort of stop in the middle. He said he believes the animosity towards the Marines and towards Americans in general increased as a result of the attack, and that then once they stopped, it put them in a position of having really just making them look indecisive. As he said, I think it would be better in these situations not to vacillate. You know, he was quite diplomatic. He said, of course, we don't know what would have happened if things had gone differently. But he said, I wish we had had a chance to implement the policy we came here with, which was to have gradual diplomacy, steady pressure, and, you know, really try to understand the culture that we were working with.
Howard LaFranchi, Anthony Cordesman is writing about how much of the development effort or plans for Iraq have not unfolded, have not been successful. So on that front, many holes in the cheese. On the military front, the U.S. seems trapped. On the one hand, if they do nothing, the insurgency spreads. If they attack, they may anger Iraqis and create more insurgents. How do you see that dynamic playing out now? Is there room for more assertive U.S. military action without a kind of without it backfiring?
Well, I think as Anne was saying, that, you know, maybe 6 months ago to do something different might have worked, but right now, I don't think they have, you know, they're left with either the option of rolling in and sort of cleaning out these places, or sort of, you know, making the surgical strikes as they're doing now and waiting for more Iraqi security forces to be trained and brought on, because the last thing they want to do is, again, get in a situation where they have to occupy cities. It's just a downward spiraling deterioration. And so what they're trying to do, they're saying now, is you know, sort of move into places where they think they can, as in Samarra last week, and try to get local agreements where they can start doing some work, start trying to redevelop some kind of relations with the local population, and sort of keep things somewhat under control while they get more Iraqi forces trained and ready. If they do have to move into to places and really just do some, not just its air power, but in some of the really worst cases, if they have to go in actual troops, that they have the Iraqis to sort of take over for them afterwards, so that it's not the reoccupation by the Americans. But the problem is that every week it seems Baghdad is looking encircled by places, and there are more and more attacks right in the heart of Baghdad. So I think one thing is the strategy. Maybe 6 months ago, if some of these trouble spots had been taken a little more seriously instead of letting them deteriorate as they seem to, it might have worked better.
Anthony Cordes, when you write about the administration now rushing in funds for what you describe as the Vietnamization of military operations in Iraq, that is going local, going to the Iraqis, the goal to have 100 or 200,000 Iraqis in a national security force by sometime next year, a lot is riding on this. Do you see this as likely to be trained up in a timely fashion, and B, even with 100,000 or 200,000 Iraqi forces, with what we've seen of this force's performance, can they really change the reality?
Well, first, I think you need to understand the context, and the latest polls we have in Iraq date back to June. There'll be some others coming out shortly. But they follow a very consistent pattern. First, Iraqis are not pessimistic, although they recognize the problems. If you look at how Iraqis view their own security forces and their own military, the two polls that are most important are the Oxford poll and another done by the U.S. Embassy, you end up with the fact that something like 80% of Iraqis see the new police as an effective force and one that's progressive, and a slightly smaller number sees that as being true of the Iraqi army. You know, they don't care that they're not totally successful in defeating the insurgents. That's an American concern. And admittedly, these date back to June, but they show a consistent trend. If you look in contrast at how Iraqis have viewed U.S. and coalition forces, the Oxford poll showed that back in October of last year, something like 80% of Iraqis had no confidence in the coalition and the U.S. and British forces. And that figure as of June, which was the latest survey, was 81%, which is pretty much what the embassy has found. And when you look at those numbers, you see why there's so much pressure to use the Iraqis for these missions, quite aside from the problem of U.S. casualties. It is also a reality, however, that there are about 4 battalion equivalents right now of truly effective Iraqi forces. They're not going to have significant numbers until the end of this year, and they're really not going to be built up to any kind of combat effective strength until sometime like May or June of next year. So it's simply too early to judge how effective these forces can be. The Iraqis want them, and they want us out. But how well we can do, that's too early to say.
And a lot hinges on that. Anthony Cordesman in Washington, Ann Bernard and Howard LaFranchi in Baghdad. Please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about the U.S. effort in Iraq now. A tough few weeks here. Fears of flirting with failure. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with correspondents in Baghdad and Anthony Cordesman in Washington about the situation in Iraq. It has not been good lately. And for the first time in a long time, the word failure flirts around the edges. Nobody says it's inevitable or anything like that. But yet, there have been failures in the first year. If there are more failures on that scale in the year ahead, who knows what the situation in Iraq is going to look like, and the United States is invested deeply. We're joined tonight by Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and in Baghdad by Ann Bernard, Correspondent for the Boston Globe, and Howard LaFranchi, Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Ann Bernard, let me ask you, if I may, about the insurgency. Of course, it wasn't so long ago that Donald Rumsfeld was dismissing them as dead-enders. The number that was put out was about 5,000. Then we've seen lots of development in activity and apparently numbers, and also different kinds of insurgents. I mean, the foreign insurgents, the Ba'athist loyalists, if that still even applies, and then the Shiite Muqtada al-Sadr crew. How do you describe the insurgency in Iraq today?
Well, it's very complicated, and even to call it one insurgency doesn't make that much sense, although we all do it as a shorthand. But really, when you talk to military commanders, Iraqi government, Iraqis on the street, no one really can explain how the different parts of the insurgency fit together. The Marines say that in Fallujah, once they pulled out of the city and essentially handed over the city to rival gangs, those gangs immediately started to fight amongst themselves because there are so many different competing interests. There's raw criminal gangs that are just trying to exploit and continue the chaos for profit. Some of the kidnappings they do may in turn be used to fuel political groups, although that relationship is pretty murky still. You have Arab nationalists, pro-Ba'athist, Iraqi patriots, Islamists. You have every stripe in between those parts of the spectrum. So the problem is really that the insurgency in the past month or so has seemed to be stronger. We talked to Iraqis yesterday on the street who said, we're losing support. We're losing enthusiasm for this insurgency. We no longer believe it's directed at the Americans. It seems to be directed at us. But yet, they seem to be getting stronger. They seem to be able to attack in the middle of Baghdad. When they hit a police station yesterday, it wasn't just a random car going by. The same police station was mortared earlier in the morning and was cased out by suspicious men right before the bombing happened. 2 days before, you had coordinated attacks all around Baghdad. And you now have a new phenomenon, which is Abu Musab al-Zarqawi claiming responsibility for particular acts. That's the Jordanian who the Pentagon blames for a lot of the terrorism in Iraq.
Right.
Although, again, it's simplistic to suggest that he's behind all of it.
With the putative al-Qaeda chief there. Howard LaFranchi, let me ask you, with all of these different strands to the insurgency or the insurgencies, how do people interpret motive? What do the different groups of insurgents want?
Well, when you look at attacks, for example, yesterday's attack on the police station, clearly that's an attempt to discourage Iraqis from supporting the new interim government. I mean, the interim government is seen as the pawn of the United States, and so it's a stepladder sort of relationship that they're attacking here. You attack the Iraqis who are, you know, showing by seeking jobs with the police that they're on that side, and you know, what better way than to attack those recruits? I mean, that's not something new. I mean, this was the biggest loss of life in the last 6 months. But 6 months ago, there was a similar attack on a police station in Bakuba where police recruits were also lined up out in front.
Yeah. Howard, I get that as a tactic. I get that as a tactic. But let me ask you, what's the larger goal here? I mean, do they want, even if they want the U.S. to leave, and then what?
Well, you don't have commanders to go to. You don't have people that you can go and ask those questions to. And so it's really hard to say. It remains very murky. I mean, clearly the Ba'athists, I do think that, you know, there is for some, there's a goal of causing a civil war, a sort of a religious war between the Shiites and the Sunnis, and maybe causing a breakup of the country, maybe with the realization that they couldn't control the entire country of Iraq, but if it broke up with the Kurds going off with their region and maybe the South becoming a Shia stronghold, that the Sunnis and perhaps a religious extremist group could take over in the center. Now, that may be their, the goal, because there does seem to be attempts to cause this, sort of a agitation and, you know, growing sense of division among Iraqis. And so this, you know, creating the, you know, the conditions for a civil war, I mean, that seems to be one of the goals. But again, you don't have anyone to go to ask, you know, what's your goal in doing this?
And Bernard, clearly there's no one you can simply ask that question to. But let me put the same question to you. This is, after all, what the United States and the interim Iraqi government are up against. What do you hear? How do you interpret the large goals of the insurgents in Iraq beyond criminality and opportunism to the extent that these are strategic? What's the strategy?
Well, if you can point to any global strategy, it's just to maximize the amount of chaos and I think the amount of fear and insecurity on the part of Iraqis. So, I mean, there's no other explanation for a lot of these attacks. So whether that means just purely making it too expensive for the United States to stay in terms of blood, in terms of money, in terms of time, you know, maybe it's as simple as that. Or maybe it is something more complicated, trying to get Iraqis to be nostalgic for the old days and bring back a Ba'athist regime. That's certainly the interpretation of some in the Pentagon. Or, you know, maybe it's truly becoming a battleground for Islamists versus Western-oriented governments and the United States. That was one of the most disturbing things that Prime Minister Alawi said when we met with him on Saturday, which was the third anniversary of September 11th. Here you have the U.S.-backed Prime Minister of the country that was supposed to be a beacon for the transformation of the Middle East and was supposed to prevent, this attack was supposed to prevent terrorist attacks on the United States. In fact, he said that Iraq has now become a base for terrorists from all over the world, and he listed countries from Morocco to Europe to all parts of the world, which he didn't really offer proof that there are people from all those countries in Iraq, but it certainly has the potential to become a new Afghanistan, a place where people come from all over the world to fight jihad.
Anthony Cordesman, we were struck by something that Clifford May said in the last couple of days. Clifford May, president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, is a conservative think tank, former director of communications for the Republican National Committees. And he said, I'm paraphrasing, but I think he said, failure is not an option in Iraq, but it just became a possibility, i.e. things are going just that poorly there. Is there a point at which the United States has to commit somehow much more to Iraq for a victory, many more troops somehow to Iraq? What kind of hinge point are we at here?
Well, first, no one, I think, believes that by putting more troops in, we can solve the problem. You asked, what are the strategic goals? Well, you don't have to have a goal as to what you're for if you know what you're against. And the one thing virtually all of these movements have in common is they want the United States out. Putting more troops in without area training, without political liaison, without a credible government is not an option the United States is either considering or has any reason to consider. The real issue here, again, is are we going to have the time to bring effective Iraqi security forces online if we can? Can we cobble together enough of an election to create something approaching a more legitimate interim government, and Iraqis and public opinion polls indicate they want a strong leader a great deal more than they want equity? And whether we can get some kind of economy at least to the point where Iraqis feel there's progress? Those are the critical questions. Now, if we can't do that, several things are almost certain to happen. One, as was pointed out earlier, is we're going to be on the edge of civil war. Another is that failure is probably going to bring an Iraqi government to power that's going to ask us to leave. And the two real credible exit strategies here are that we lose the support of the interim government or whatever government takes its place, or that it simply becomes clear in the form of civil war that there's no point in staying. In that case, unfortunately, defeat is all too thinkable.
Well, it has been a fascinating, if chilling, hour. Ann Bernard and Howard LaFranchi in Baghdad, I want to thank each of you for being with us. I know it's getting late there. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. And Anthony Cordesman in Washington, great as always to speak with you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, Martha Stewart asks to begin her prison sentence. Martha Stewart is heading to prison. The domestic diva announced today that she wants to begin serving her 5-month sentence as soon as possible, rather than wait for the appeal of her conviction. Stewart maintains that she has a strong case for appeal and will reportedly, apparently on principle, go ahead with it. But she said today the best way for her to move on is to head to the big house right away. Her appeal will not be heard until sometime next year, and many legal experts say she has little chance of having her conviction overturned. Stewart was convicted in March of lying to investigators who were probing her questionable sale of 4,000 shares of stock in Imclone Systems, a company run by her friend Sam Waxel. "I know I am doing the right thing for me and for my family, my colleagues, and my company," Stewart said during a news conference at her company's New York headquarters. "And the relief I feel at putting this behind me is great.
I cannot bear any longer the prolonged suffering while I and my legal team await vindication in the next step of the legal process, the appeal. And although I and my attorneys firmly believe in the strength of that appeal, recent delays and extensions have now made it abundantly clear that my appeal will not be heard until sometime next year. So I have decided to serve my sentence now, to put this nightmare behind me and get on with my life and living as soon as possible. Believe me when I tell you that I fully understand the importance of closure, not only to my family, friends, and supporters, but especially to our loyal and caring employees, our loyal and steadfast advertisers, our wonderfully supportive business partners. It has been a trying and long ordeal for all of us, and it is time to get it all behind us, behind me, so we can move forward. I know I have a very tough 5 months ahead of me, but I understand, too, that I will get through those months knowing that I have the ability to return to my productive and normal life, my interesting work, and future business opportunities, supported through the ordeal by my friends and colleagues and loved ones. I am very sad knowing that I will miss the holiday season, Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, always an opportunity to celebrate family, friends, and religious traditions that mean so much to many of us. And I will miss all of my pets, my 2 beloved fun-loving dogs, my 7 lively cats, my canaries, my horses, and even my chickens. It's odd what becomes of immense importance when one realizes one's freedom is about to be curtailed, and it is frightening and difficult to have to grasp those realizations. Unfortunately, there is no way to know today exactly when or how long it will take the Bureau of Prisons to be able to arrange for me to begin serving my sentence, or where I will serve it. I do hope that there will be room at the Danbury facility, which is the prison nearest to my home and close enough so that my 90-year-old mother and others can visit me. I hope, too, that I will be able to begin serving my sentence in the very near future, because I would like to be back as early in March as possible in order to plant the new spring garden and to truly get things growing again.
Martha Stewart speaking earlier today in New York City. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Cora Peterson, Lauren Madeline, and Rachel Dornhill. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.